so we have a very cool demo coming together up here to in a few minutes. But I'm going to go ahead and start. And if you remember last time, we were sort of finishing up our first discussion of basic quantum mechanics. And not only does quantum mechanics have issues with uncertainties because of the fact that you can't calculate specifically for a quantum process what's going to happen, all you can calculate is probability distribution, you also find that because you're describing, it's a theory of waves, that you have inherently uncertainties in your ability to pin down your knowledge and position and momentum simultaneously, or in energy and the lifetime of something simultaneously. And so, the size really does matter, because we don't really worry about this in the macroscopic world. In principle, in quantum physics, you can determine the position and momentum of something to arbitrary precision simultaneously. But it's really not the case for things that are waves. And it's not really the case for things that are very small. So just like in Ruhi's treatment, where the wavelength of particles become important for as the mass of particles becomes really small, the same is true in terms of your ability to actually think about trying to determine the position and momentum of something at the same time. If you hit an electron with a photon in order to localize it, an electron will actually get kicked by the photon. You don't notice that with a car, but you notice it with electrons. So where the electron was, what its momentum was, is no longer that way. So inherently in quantum mechanics, you really don't have the deterministic universe that you have in Newtonian physics, which could make you very upset, perhaps, philosophically. I hope that if it does, you'll be placated by the fact that it opens up an entire realm of fabulous possibilities that turn out to be really important. This uncertainty underlies the basics of quantum field theory, that is sort of the main theory we have in particle physics today. It also turns out to be incredibly important for cosmology and all sorts of things. So it sort of opens up the last 100 years of amazing modern physics. And often the way in which we think about the uncertainty principle is not so much in this inability to nail down the position and momentum of particles to arbitrary precision simultaneously, but more in terms of this, which basically says, if I look at a process over a shorter and shorter period of time, my knowledge of the energy of that process is less and less certain. So it sort of allows you to effectively break conservation of energy so long as you do it over an extremely short period of time, which may sound sort of ridiculous, except when you're trying to calculate what an object is and put it into quantum mechanical calculation or whatever, you have to represent it by all of its possibilities. And if I have this degree of uncertainty in energy, then when I think of something over a very short time in a quantum mechanical calculation, I have much more latitude, many more things have to fit into that calculation. So it actually ends up affecting the calculation. Another way to think about it is an electron going along. Could be an electron plus a photon breaking conservation of energy, as long as the photon comes back in a very short period of time. So you have all of these possibilities. The photon can pair produce, the pairs could emit photons. So you have sort of an infinite number of possibilities. So you don't think of a particle as a BB, you think of it as a virtual cloud of possibilities, in a sense. And that's how you look at it in quantum field theory. So if I have two of these particles that are virtual clouds and they exchange one of their virtual particles, that exchange could exchange charge, it could exchange momentum, and that's how we define a force. So we call these things exchange forces in quantum mechanics, and it really does seem sort of Harry Potter-ish, but it turns out to actually work. It's a very formal quantum mechanical theory. And a way to think about it is sort of like if you were standing on ice and pitching a heavy ball back and forth, you would convey a force between you and your partner. And that's really the picture that we have for forces in nature in the view of quantum field theory. So this is very, very different philosophically and conceptually than the Newtonian view, where we basically have a force at a distance conveyed by the fields, by the electric field or the magnetic field. It's also very different from the Einsteinian view of distorted space-time leading to the force of gravity, conceptually. We do not currently have a quantum field theory for gravity, but there's a lot of confidence in the world. There are lots of very compelling reasons to know that such a theory
has to exist. That basically, it's unavoidable that at certain size scales that you can avoid gravity having a quantum theory. But for the other three forces of nature, which we'll get into more, so the electromagnetism, the weak nuclear force, and the strong nuclear force, our hardcore theory, which seems to work to a gnat's eyebrow, is in this quantum field theory, and it views forces like this. So we're going to come back to this, because after we do some nuclear physics, I'm going to do particle physics, and we'll talk about the essence of forces. So, going fast, because we talked about this last time, but you guys okay? All right, so a quick review of what we did last time, talking about nuclear physics.
Just a reminder that atoms are made up of these very tiny nuclei that you know have to be there, because when you scatter charged particles off of thin films, once in a while, they come straight back at you, and the only way that could happen is if the positive charge in the atom is condensed in a very small spot. And it only happens now and then because you have to basically be heading right at the nucleus, and the nucleus is so small, it's like throwing a dart at a target, and you're just not, the phase space for actually hitting the target is very small. So we have this tiny nucleus where all the positive charges, we have the electrons, we have the same number of protons and electrons that we typically call Z, and we have some number of neutrons, which is often roughly equal to Z, but not quite. The chemical characteristics are defined by the number of protons, because that determines the shell structure for these electrons and the number of electrons, and it's the reorientations of that, of the electrons in the atom, that sort of gives you chemistry. Atoms are completely stable. If I have a kilogram of them sitting here now, and the building doesn't fall down around them, 1,000 years from now, I'll have a kilogram of them sitting here. So they're very stable. But many atoms are not stable. The nuclei are not particularly stable. Just like you can have an atom where an electron is in a high energy state and it decays down, you can have nuclei where you have the nucleus in a high energy state that eventually decays either down into a lower energy state of the nucleus or into another type of nucleus. So just a reminder of motivating some of this. If I have all this positive charge in such a small area, I know the Coulomb force between the positive charges is so great that this thing really should be blowing apart. It's not. So the only way around that, since we know it's small, we know it has a bunch of positive charge, is we have to invoke the existence of an attractive, strong force, which we call the strong nuclear force, that has a range of about 10 to the minus 15 meters. We know that's the range because we can shoot charged particles at nuclei with differing energies, and we know that they are repelled from the nuclei when we shoot it at them in a way as if it was just Coulomb repulsion, right up until we have enough energy to force those particles to about 10 to the minus 15 meters apart. And the minute they reach that point, the scattering goes crazy. So we know something new is happening. And we call that something new, the strong nuclear force. And we'll come back to that a bit, but I wanted to talk a little bit about what happens when you have these excited state of nuclei that then decay, and how do they decay. And so we looked at these modes. I think you'll look at them some more a week from today in recitation. You could have a nucleus, but because you have this attractive force that binds them, just like you have in the atom, when you solve Schrodinger's equation, you get discrete energy levels and discrete spatial distributions. And basically, the protons and neutrons will populate those different levels. They're fermions, so again, just like in the atom, you can't just pile them all into one ground state. They will distribute in different energy levels. You can have transitions between those energy levels, just like you have in an atom, and they can emit light photons, just like they do in an atom. So this is the symbol of photon, a gamma ray. The energy difference in the levels in the nucleus is a million times greater than it is in the atom. So those photons come off with a million times the energy, and their frequency is so high we have no prayer of seeing. So those are called, those happen to be gamma rays. But because you have so much energy involved, because you have millions of electron volts involved, you can have other types of processes happen. It might be energetically feasible for the nucleus to sort of get into a different type of nucleus by emitting an electron and basically having a neutron change into a proton. That changes Z for the atom and basically changes the type of atom. Or it could emit a two-proton, two-neutron combination that turns out to be particularly stable. That's called an alpha particle. And when it does that, because you're changing the number of protons and neutrons, what's left is a different type of nucleus. So these are forms of radioactive decay. And every particular type of nucleus you have turns out to have characteristic types of decays. It will decay into particles that have specific energies, and it will decay into them with particular probabilities. So just like the spectra that we saw for the atomic gas lamps that we saw here, we have particular transitions between atomic energy levels. For different nuclei, you will have particular energies and transitions for these probabilities for these things to come off, and they're just like fingerprints. So you can detect the gamma rays and the alpha particles and stuff coming off a nucleus, and you can determine exactly what type of nucleus you've got because of how it decayed. So it's there's a lot of similarity between nuclear physics and atomic physics, with the big difference being that the difference in the energy levels between the nuclear physics and the nuclear levels and the atomic levels is about a factor of a million. So if you're not a believer, I would like you to come up. I want everybody to come up here, actually. Let me tell you what we're talking about. What I have is a device which is known as a cloud chamber. Cloud chambers were used to detect subatomic particles as a primary research tool between the 20s and 50s. And lots of particles were discovered using these devices. What it's really a pretty simple device. You basically have a box in which you put a supersaturated vapor. So you might evaporate a bunch of alcohol into the air in the box and then cool it down to the point that it's ready to rain the alcohol. And then what happens is if you take a charged particle and pass it through that space, it deposits a little bit of energy and it turns out that the droplets will condense right along that stream of energy. So you can visualize the path of the charged particles passing through the gas. So we have this set up over here, and what we have is a needle that sticks out into this thing, and it has at the tip of the needle a little bit of radioactive thorium. Radioactive thorium decays by emitting alpha particles. Alpha particles are heavily ionizing, so they cannot get through the glass. You don't need to worry about getting irradiated by the source, the weak source. But what you can see, if you look at it carefully, is if you look in the space around the tip of the needle, you will see little straight wisps of mist that come off and then get blown away by the currents of air in the box. So you have to sort of watch for a second. But you'll see them come off in all different directions. You'll see these little fine straight wisps. And these are alpha particles passing through the gas coming from the radioactive decay. And if we wanted to watch it for a while, we could count the number of alpha particles per second coming off. We could integrate over 10 minutes. And we could do that for different periods. And we could actually calculate how the decay rate is changing with time and calculate the half-life, for example. And so this is sort of how I'm going to put this. Anyway, it's sort of cool. So come on down and take a look. You have to get close, so probably have to sort of do it linearly here. But you want to look right in this window and have to see them. Be patient. See the little whiskers. Helium atoms, just out in space. They don't disappear.
and they don't have enough energy to sort of collide with other nuclei and cause nuclear collisions, so they'll just basically become atoms. All right, so nuclear physics. So we can do a lot of things with nuclear physics that is very cool. And this diagram really drives our understanding of what it is you can do that's cool with nuclear physics and how and why. Okay? So let me take you on a tour of this. What I'm plotting is on the x-axis just the number of protons plus neutrons for all known elements. So hydrogen has one proton, it's one right here. Helium has two protons, it's number two. Carbon has 12. I guess you can barely see it in this light, but it's right here. This is really dim. I'm going to turn this on too, maybe you can see it better. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So at 12, which really looks more like 18 when I look at this. No. You see where carbon is. So that's what this is. This is called the binding energy per nucleon. It is a measure of how tightly the nuclear force inside the nucleus is holding all the protons and neutrons. So if I were to reach down with tweezers and pull a proton or a neutron out of the nucleus, if it took more energy to do that, I would be higher up on this graph. Okay? And a way to think about it is a nucleus which holds its nucleons really tightly is more stable energetically. Okay? If it's about to fall apart, it's easy to move nucleons from it. Then it's not actually held very, they aren't held very tightly together. Or another way to think about it is, if I had a bag of nucleons that were free, protons and neutrons, and I somehow could shove them together, the energy with which they're being held in that nucleus would be released. Didn't say that well. If I have this nucleus, in order to separate all of these nucleons, I would have to put a tremendous amount of energy into it. So it's a much lower energy state for those nucleons. So different nuclei out there have different degrees of stability. Okay? And what this plot is telling you is that things that are more stable are up higher than things that are down lower. Okay? So, what does that mean? What it tells us is that the most stable nucleus that's out there is iron 56, iron 57, right in here. It's iron. And what it says is that if I were to take small nuclei and somehow, if I had enough energy to push them together into and create a larger nucleus up to around iron, I would release a great deal of energy. Okay? And that's called nuclear fusion, because you're fusing together small nuclei into large ones. But notice that around iron, it starts to fall off. So you're less stable over here. So what it says over here is if I take a really, really big nucleus and I split it up into two smaller nuclei, I will release a lot of energy. And that's known as nuclear fission. And it basically tells me if I've got a chunk of iron, there's not much I can do to generate energy. And this curve actually will make some sense if you were to imagine that the size of a nucleon is like this, and somehow the size of the nuclear force is a bit bigger. Then you can imagine that if I have a couple of small nucleons, like that, and if I were to now bind them together, like so, you may notice that the density of these little green pink force lines that I sort of drew starts to increase. So if the nuclear force is a bit bigger in its range than the size of a nucleon, as I add some more nucleons together, they're sort of all pulling on each other. And that makes for a much more strongly bound state. But if I get really big because I add 200 of them together, okay, now the nucleus itself is vastly larger than the range of the nuclear force that might be given off by a single nucleon. So that, in a sense, this thing has gotten big and unwieldy, and this nucleon is only bound to a few over here, this one's only bound to a few over here, and you sort of saturate the strength of the thing. In the meantime, it's getting bigger and bigger, and you're always adding positive charges in, which, remember, is a repulsive force. So the bigger this thing is, the more repulsion you have pushing out, and you don't gain by having more and more nuclear force because it saturates in terms of its distance. So what that means is if you're pretty small and you get somewhat bigger, then you're holding things more and more tightly, and you have an energetically more bound system. And that's why this curve grows. But then you reach a point where you're so big, as you're adding more and more of these protons, it wants to blow it apart, and it's so big that no longer does the strong force of individual nucleons glom onto everything. They sort of limited in how far they can go. So as you add more protons, it starts to be less and less stable, which is why, as you get bigger here, this starts going down. Okay? Any thoughts, questions? I'd like you to sort of keep this in mind, because we're going to talk about basic nuclear physics applications right now. But keep it in mind, maybe by the end of the class you'll understand why this is really important, not just for nuclear bombs and things, but it actually drives the essence of what's happening with stars and the cosmos. So there's a whole lot of nuclear physics that goes on, and it drives a whole lot of what we see. So that's the idea. You can shove together small nuclei and release more energy than it takes to shove them together, if you can manage to shove them together, up until about iron. And then once you're past iron, if you shove them together, you're losing energy. But if you have big things, you break them apart. Okay? Any questions? All right. So let's look at implications of this. First of all, if you calculate how much force it takes to take two small nuclei that are both positively charged and push them to where they're 10 to the minus 15 meters apart, which is where the strong force sort of kicks in, then you could begin to fuse them. So that is, if you ask, how hard is it to take things here and put them there? Practically, it's incredibly hard, because it takes a vast amount of force and energy to take two nuclei and make them approach each other that close. Even if when they get that much more close, when they get that close, they might glom onto each other and release more energy than it took for you to shove them in, it still takes a tremendous amount of energy for you to do. I mean, way more energy than we typically have in processes that we typically see. This, on the other hand, is a little easier to do. If you have a big nucleus, it's pretty unstable, and it's sort of wanting to fall apart. So if you could basically just kick it a little bit, it might fall apart. When it does, it would basically undergo fission, that is, it would fission into two smaller nuclei and it might disintegrate. So, technically, if you want to try to do something like this in the laboratory, this is the route that you want to start with, because it's relatively simple to do. And so, I want to talk for a moment about what we call nuclear fission. And you could do this with many different types of nuclei.
But a particular type that turns out to have practical and strategic importance is uranium-235. Now, just to remind you, uranium has 92 protons. Every uranium nucleus that ever existed has 92 protons by definition. That's what we mean by uranium. It has that many protons. That determines what the electrons are doing, how many electrons and how their shell structure is, and that determines the chemistry. Okay? However, if you go out and you find a shovel full of dirt that has uranium ore in it, and you look at the uranium nuclei that are in there, only a small fraction of them will be uranium-235. What we mean by 235 is that it has 235 minus 92 neutrons that are in the nucleus. And you have other uranium nuclei that have differing numbers of neutrons. We call those isotopes. The one that is most prominent in the material that you would find out in Earth is uranium-238, which is the majority of what uranium ore is. Now, chemically, uranium-235 and 238 are very, very similar. So it's really hard to separate. You have to work quite hard to do it technically. Uranium-238 weighs a tiny bit more, so you can use really powerful centrifuges and actually separate. Like, if you put them in a centrifuge as a gas, then the U-238 gas will actually go a little bit, be pressed a little bit more toward the outer end of the centrifuge than the 235. And you can suck off the 235 at a radius a little closer to the center relative to the 238. That's one way to do it. Why do we care? Why we care is that if you have U-238, it can undergo a process whereby if you manage to hit it with a neutron, that neutron will cause it to split. When it splits, it will typically split into rubidium and cesium. Okay? This is long-lived and highly radioactive, which means if you have a lot of this process going on, you don't want to be anywhere near it, even thousands of years later, because this stuff is still sitting there, which is the problem in Fukushima right now, by the way. So uranium goes into rubidium and cesium. And remember, you now have taken something very big that's not so stable and turned it into something, two things that are smaller, both where they're more tightly held, and you'll release energy. That energy is released in terms of the kinetic energy of the rubidium and cesium nuclei. They're moving around. They also will release a cascade of gamma rays. So that's a form of energy. That's light, okay, but just very high frequency. And this is the thing that makes it really important for us, it will release two neutrons. And that's the key to making this a really interesting sort of process. Let us imagine that I have a pile of uranium-235. Once in a while, a uranium-235 nucleus is going to spontaneously decay because it is naturally unstable, so it will decay. So if you have one of the uranium-235 nuclei decay, and you are surrounded by uranium-235, but not a lot of it, there's a pretty reasonable probability that those neutrons will escape without hitting another uranium-235 nucleus. And if that's true, we call this subcritical. I wouldn't want to eat it, I wouldn't want to sleep on it, because you'll be hitting neutrons, but this is no big deal. If you now have a bigger pile of uranium-235, then you'll have a probability that if you have a decay and you create two neutrons, one of them is going to hit another one of the U-235 nuclei in that pile. And we say that that's critical. And this is a big deal because it means if I have a decay here, one of these neutrons may disappear, but the other one's going to cause another decay, and it will have caused another decay. So what you're going to have is the sample, when it becomes critical, you're going to have a lot of neutrons being kicked out. The activity will become much greater, because no longer do you just have the natural radioactivity that's happening. You are inducing activity from the decays that happen, because the neutrons will go and hit the other neutrons. Then the fun starts if you have a bigger cloud. If you have yet a bigger cloud, you have an amplification, because you may have a decay which creates two neutrons, and now both of them will cause decays of two neutrons, which will then cause decays of two neutrons, and you will have an exponential increase in the number of decays that are happening at the time. And this happens really, really, really fast. If you have this happen, if it goes critical, perhaps even subcritical, because if you have enough decays, but there's a level at which, if it's happening fast enough, it may not be explosive, but if you do not get the energy out, if you don't cool it down, it's going to become too hot and it will melt everything right around it. That would basically be what's known as melt. You then start a fire. The fire then burns stuff and sends radioactive products in the air, and that's not good. If you take this process and you can put enough of the material together fast enough such that it doesn't melt down first, then it becomes explosive, and that's a nuclear explosion.
Any questions on that?
I have a question not related to that.
Yeah.
So what were the name of the things that we saw in the box?
The element that's doing the decaying here is thorium.
From the sun.
Okay. The particles that are coming off from the thorium we see is alphas, and the particles that are coming from showers of things that happen at the top of the atmosphere due to particles hitting the top of the atmosphere. Generically, we call them cosmic rays, but in fact, they're muons, muons.
What sort of materials do muons and pop pass through?
Muons can pass through anything, but they do range out. So if you go a kilometer into the Earth, the flux of muons is substantially less than it is at the surface of the Earth. And in fact, we have to cite many physics experiments in deep mines, really, just to avoid the flux of these particles coming in randomly from other processes. So it's a strange sort of thing. On the other hand, the discovery of the positron and the muon themselves were done by cosmic rays. Basically, you can take a cloud chamber like this and you put it in a region. The cosmic rays vary in energy. Sometimes they really have a lot of energy, and some of them have enough energy to actually cause nuclear reactions inside the cloud chamber itself. And so you can study those. And so a guy named Anderson, who studied cosmic rays, discovered the positron in photographs of things happening in a cloud chamber from high energy cosmic rays. So you can use it as a beam sometimes. It varies. And in fact, it's directly associated with how much carbon-14 is in the atmosphere. So you did one recitation where you talked about carbon-14 dating. So the carbon-14 is created in the atmosphere from particles hitting the top of the atmosphere, creating cosmic rays. In the nuclear reactions, they have a top. They can generate a little bit of carbon-14. So please stop. All right, any questions about criticality and the fission of, say, uranium? Uranium is not the only isotope that you can fission and get energy out of, but it has this fabulous property that when it fissions, you produce the two neutrons, which basically then can cause other fissions. This process here would be called a chain reaction. you can initiate it by just having one decay, and then if you have it critical, it will create a lot of energy very fast. Okay, so if you do this slowly, and you basically bring the amount of material you've got up to something close to criticality, but not too close, then it generates a bunch of heat. And if you do that here, and you circulate gas or liquid through it, it can run a turbine. And then you cool that gas off, and you send it back through, heat it up, and you have power generation. And this is the basic design of a nuclear power plant. And the real trick is that you have to, one, have the stuff that is radioactive tightly controlled in a loop. So your cooling is done by a separate loop of material. So these are all built right by oceans or lakes or something. So Gené is on the lake, Fukushima is on the ocean. Because you have to have the cooling water in order to drain off the extra energy. The tricky stuff is in here, in that you have to make sure that a way to think about it is you put the radioactive material in rods, and as you have more rods close together, you'll have more interactions, and you can bring it closer to criticality. There's also something called a moderator, which is you can have it inside a material that slows the neutrons down, and that can enhance or degrade the chance of the neutrons causing the decay of the uranium. So there's a complex process of controlling this. The big deal happens, and what happened in Fukushima is if you lose power, which is sort of ironic given that you're generating power at this thing, but if you lost power and you can't circulate this cooling fluid, or you can't control these rods or whatever, then this gets hotter and hotter thermally. And it can boil off, it can melt stuff. So in fact, even if you safely shut down this nuclear reaction area, the rods eventually, you have the uranium is getting depleted because it's splitting. So eventually you have to replace the rods. So they take the rods out, they're literally rods of nuclear fuel that's been depleted, but it's still got a lot of radioactive stuff in it. And so you have to take it, and you can't just set it down, because if you just set it down, there's enough residual radioactivity in it that it gets very hot and it will melt down in an uncontrolled way, and then you can have radioactive material in there. So they take these rods, and one thing they do is they put them in big cooling pools. And literally, it's just a pool of water that takes the heat, and you sort of circulate that water so that you take the heat away. And then it's safe until you can't circulate water anymore. And then it boils the water away, and then you've got all these things sitting there with all the residual radioactivity, and they get very, very hot, and they melt, and they start fires, and that's the machine. That's a meltdown. And so that's, and when they are talking about, one of the things that is very strange about the design of those nuclear power plants is they actually have the cooling pools up on top of them. So the integrity of the cooling pools is problematic when you have real issues up and down underneath and stuff. So it's a, anyway, we could go on and on about it, but it was a different type of reactor in Russia, Chernobyl, that melted down, and it was a big chunk of graphite with rods, and graphite being carbon will moderate the neutrons. So you use graphite to actually also control the speed of the nuclear reaction. And anyway, so the idea with nuclear power is to generate these nuclear reactions in a subcritical, approaching critical sort of way, and just pull the energy out as fast as you can, basically, and then that allows you to So these designs aren't perfect. Modern designs are better. So you shouldn't be super duper scared of new design nuclear stuff, but the old stuff, is some of these fail safes are a bit problematic. Fukushima is not a good thing. Okay, so if in fact you don't want to power a city, but you want to vaporize a city, then your philosophy is a little different. What you want to do to create a nuclear explosion is to take subcritical samples of the uranium and bring them together fast enough that they don't melt, they don't lose their integrity, and it becomes critical. Because if you can bring it together and contain it long enough that it's critical for long enough, then it releases so much energy that it's uncontainable and you have a nuclear explosion. So there were are a couple of primary designs for nuclear warheads. One is called a gun type, which you can't see super well here. The one that that was dropped on Hiroshima in 1945 was this type, and it is made of uranium-235. And the way it works is it's sort of long, and I don't know if you can see it well, but there's a piece of uranium right here, which sort of looks like a donut, and it's subcritical. And you have a piece of uranium right here that looks like a plug. And basically, you have a stick of dynamite right here that blows this plug very fast directly into the middle of that donut. And when you do that fast enough, you create a mass that's now critical, and there's your explosion. Okay? There is a different type of bomb. The one that was dropped on Nagasaki, they used plutonium instead of uranium. And plutonium has similar properties in terms of how it reacts if it causes a chain reaction. In this case, technically, and I'm not sure I understand the technical reasons, and I mean, nuclear weapons design isn't my thing, but to do plutonium bombs, what you do is you have the plutonium arranged in a sphere out here, actually the blue, the inner blue, or this, you see a yellow shell, and just inside that you see sort of a dark blue shell. So you put the plutonium in this dark blue shell, and you surround the plutonium with high explosives. And you set it up so that all of these high explosives detonate simultaneously. When they do, they will compress this mass of plutonium into a much smaller ball, and it becomes critical, and then it explodes. Okay. So there are real issues here. It turns out that plutonium is relatively easy to get in terms of if you find plutonium, you don't have to isolate a particular isotope of it so much. The problem with building one of these bombs, which you should be thankful for, is problematic, is that you have to have absolutely exact timing for all of these explosives in order to make this thing actually compress instead of just blow out one side. So technically, that's really hard to do. And in fact, the technology for making that happen is really quite difficult, and people track it very carefully. So if somebody wants to build a nuclear warhead, they start investigating how to time explosions to exquisite detail, and when you do that, people come looking for you, as they should. And it's technically very, very hard to do. The uranium bomb, on the other hand, is if I have the 235, this isn't so hard to build. You need basically a stick of dynamite, and you say go, and it blows it together, and you've got a bomb. What saves us here is that most of the uranium that we find is the U-238. So there's only a small percentage, like a percent or two, of U-235, that is 0.8%, in natural radioactive ore. So in order to make an explosion happen, you need it to be about 90% pure uranium-235. So
you have to enrich it. So you hear all this crap about uranium enrichment in Iran, and it is all about death. It is technically hard to take uranium ore and separate the U-238 from the U-235. And typically to do it, you have to have a lot of really strong big centrifuges to basically take some uranium hexafluoride gas and separate the isotopes because of this very small mass difference between the U-238 and the U-235. There are other ways to separate them, and during World War II, we did it multiple ways in the Manhattan Project, but it's a big deal and it's hard to do. And again, people track purchases of high-strength steel that you need for these centrifuges and the kinds of parts that go into these specialized centrifuges to try to figure out who's trying to enrich uranium and who isn't. But when they talk about what's going on in Iran right now, it's a slow process to take the natural uranium ore and enrich it up to about 20%. But apparently it's not that hard. Once you have the centrifuges and you have uranium that pure, you can enrich it fairly fast up to the 90%. And so you hear a lot about, you know, what's going on in Iran, how big is their 20% enriched stockpile and stuff like that. And it all really boils down to how much of the really pure U-235 they can get, which they could in principle put into a bomb. Any thoughts, questions?
Isn't there anyone who figured out how to like make U-235 easier way to change?
So the question is, anybody found an easier way to make U-235? Not in bulk that I know of. So, I'm sort of happy to say, because you really don't want your neighbor down the street to be able to do this in their basement.
What was the heavy water for?
The deuterium. You know, that's a good question. I think it basically acts more as a moderator. I don't think it's used as nuclear fuel per se. It's used as a way of helping control the process, I believe. But actually, it's a good question. I'm not sure I really know the answer. It would be something I'm not thinking about.
Do you think the benefits of using nuclear energy outweigh the risks of like meltdown or something like that?
Wow, that sounds like a great essay question. I mean, I think if you don't consider global warming, maybe you would argue the benefits of nuclear power might not be worth it. If you consider global warming, it's not so obvious to me because it's one of the few ways we have of trying to control that problem. The other thing is that people, I think, do not usually consider is that when you have a meltdown, it is devastating. Okay, I would not move back to Fukushima, and I wouldn't if I were a thousand years from now. And that's a pretty devastating thing. And if you have that happen a lot, it would really, really destroy us, right? It could be very bad thing. But if you actually calculate the increase or the number of deaths that you could attribute directly to nuclear power versus coal power, you might be very surprised. Because coal, although you don't have the instantaneous, terrible issue of a meltdown potential, if you break a coal plant, the very worst thing you're going to get is a nasty fire or something. It basically just stops working, so you're not going to have that problem. But it is constantly emitting tremendous amounts of carcinogens into the atmosphere that we're all breathing. You do have a global warming issue. So when you calculate the overall risk assessment, it's not so clear. And think that's something that is often sort of omitted in the conversations that nation states have about nuclear power. I do think we could do nuclear power a lot better. I do know that there are modern designs where the risk factor is much, much smaller. What we haven't talked about is when you have this fuel rod, I mean, we talked a little bit about meltdowns and stuff, but you get lots of fuel rods that the container vessel, it's all radioactive. It's so radioactive, you can't put it next door. You have to really store it safely away. You can't store it somewhere where it might break down due to weather and go into your water table. So you have to store it very carefully. And we have not, as a society, at least in the U.S., done a very good job of doing that. You have to transport. I mean, these are all huge.
Space. Just like shoot out in space.
But then you have, you shoot it out in space, it costs a tremendous amount of money per kilogram to send it.
Right.
And then that takes a tremendous amount of cost and energy and money to produce the rockets and rocket fuel.
Right.
And so there's these calculations are really complex. And so to be fair to the nuclear industry, you really should ask things like, how safe is gas? How safe is coal, etc.? Yeah.
The storage of spent nuclear fuel, the item too. Is there, what do they do for long term? Do they think about the long
term? Well, people have thought about the problem, and I really can't tell you how it's solved in other countries. And here it's not well solved. I mean, they will take the stuff and they will effectively enclose it in glass and put it in barrels and store these barrels in places. And or they'll have fuel rods and they'll put them in cooling pools. If you ever see pictures of these nuclear things in cooling pools, they're actually fabulous pictures, because what happens is the particles that are emitted into the case are coming off faster than the speed of light in the water. When we talk about index of refraction, which means the speed of light in the material is less than c. But if the particle is going faster than the speed of light in the material, it actually will emit an optical shock wave, which is in the blue. So you get this absolutely beautiful blue glow out of this thing. So if you've ever seen pictures of copper cooling pools, that's not funky photography light. It gives you the really beautiful blue that's surrounding the scenes. It's actually the particles emitting light. So the ultimate strategy in the United States for radioactive material storage was to send it all to New Mexico near Carlsbad, a place called the Waste Isolation Pilot or something like that, called WIP. WIPP. WIP consists of big tunnels carved out in a huge formation of salt. Salt, because it's very dry and very geologically stable, it flows a little bit, but the problem is you can put a lot of things down there and never have a problem. And I don't know if you were paying attention to the news about a month ago, but they actually had detectors around WIP that caught whiff of radioactive substance, and apparently they had a little fire inside the whiff, which caused the problem. And so it's been very controversial. The people in Mexico weren't too wild about having this facility to begin with. And the whole idea of saying this is the ultimate storage facility takes a hit when we have a little fire and it emits something. So I don't know. I think that's a real problem that I don't think we've solved very well. Yeah.
Why do we need to circulate water in nuclear power stations?
Why do we need to circulate water?
Like to cool it down.
Well, you circulate. It's usually actually something like liquid lithium or some sort of metal. You circulate a liquid through the core where it gets really hot, and that then is the heat that drives your generator. Okay, and then. There's thermodynamics basically tells you that you can't get 100% of the energy out of the system and make it useful for electricity. So you will have
excess energy that you basically have to bleed off into the atmosphere. And this is, I think, not trivially understandable. I'm not a huge thermo fan. I mean, I've done the math, but there are limits to what you can do, and so you have to have a way of actually bleeding off some of that excess energy. So one of the things you'll see are these big cooling towers near nuclear power plants. If you've ever seen one, there'll basically be a cloud of steam coming off, because it's really just a great big cooling tower that's cooling the water that they're using to cool the coolant that is circulating through the core of the nuclear reactor. So it's a physical reality that you're sort of stuck having to cool it down. I don't know if that's a good answer for you, but okay. So what we've just been talking about is nuclear fission. And the reason that we've been talking about nuclear fission for practical purposes is, in principle, if I have the right material, I can start the process by just sending a neutron in, which in fact I can get for free from a uranium nucleus, which, if I have 1,000 of them sitting here, some of them will just spontaneously decay over time. Okay, so that, and when they do, you get the neutron. So that's easy to initiate in principle. You might consider nuclear fusion instead of nuclear fission. And one of the things you might notice is that this is very steep. So if I were to take two nuclei here and shove them together, generally speaking, I get more energy release than you'll typically have when I break something apart. The other thing that happens is that the stuff that I produce over here is not generally radioactive, so I don't have radioactive residual stuff left from a fusion reaction, generally. The problem with this is I have to initiate it. And to initiate it, I have to take two small nuclei and make them approach each other, which means it takes a lot of energy. So I'm going to talk a lot about stars in a few minutes, and then we'll talk more about the early universe. And it turns out that when I talk about heat, when I say I make something hot, the measure of heat is the kinetic energy of the particles that are in the substance. If it's hotter, they're moving faster. They have more kinetic energy. So one way to try to take two nuclei and make them come together with so much energy that they get close enough for fusion to happen is to take some material and heat it up to the point the kinetic energy is so great that they can do that. Okay? That turns out to be really hot. I mean, like 40,000 degrees hot. I mean, really, really hot. So we have created fusion reactions on Earth. In fact, most of the most powerful nuclear warheads are actually called thermonuclear warheads because the main energy is coming from fusion. But the trigger for those bombs, the way you get them hot enough to start fusing this stuff to create the more powerful explosion, is by planting a small nuclear device, a small nuclear explosion right in the middle of it. So that's the match that sets off the big explosion. So thermonuclear bombs mean you use fusion, and these were developed in, I don't know, the 50s or so. And so when you start talking about, you know, these really big nuclear warheads, they generally have a small fission warhead that is then surrounded by materials like small nuclei, like tritium and lithium and things like that, that you can basically ignite with the match of the fission warhead, which might be small, and then you have a huge energy release with this fusion device. People dream about creating a reactor which is built on fusion instead of fission. And the idea for that is it takes a lot of energy to get fusion to start happening.
In fact, it takes so much energy to put in it to make it happen that if I had a power outage, the whole thing would just stop. So you don't run a risk of meltdowns and things like that. So that's one thing. The other thing is you could imagine running out of uranium just like we run out of might run out of oil. Fusion, you can imagine actually using tritium, which is really just an isotope of hydrogen, which you actually can just extract from seawater. So there's effectively an unlimited supply of fuel if you can make fusion. So people are working on making fusion happen in the laboratory, and there are two primary technologies. One is to take a gas and put it in sort of a donut-shaped thing, and you ionize the gas so that it's mostly, you know, so it's basically just nuclei, and we call it electrons free. So we call that a plasma. And then you can send effectively microwaves into the plasma, and they get hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter. And because it's charged particles, you can set up a magnetic field in such a way that you can keep the charge, you can keep the gas from hitting the walls of the container. Because if it gets hot enough, they'll melt the container. So you confine it to the magnetic field, and you keep getting it hotter and hotter. And eventually, you make it hot enough that you might even form thermonuclear reactions. So this is something known as atomic act, and there's a we have such a thing at the plasma physics laboratory at Princeton. The cutting edge device that's being built is called ITER, I-T-E-R, which is being built in France. The problem is an extraordinarily expensive device. It's very big. It's taking huge resources. I forget the price tag, but I think you know $30 million is on the order of what we're talking about. And we haven't really yet figured out how to put it and get enough fusion happening to have more energy or even extract the energy, much less get enough of it happening that it's self-sustaining or that you pull out more energy than you put in. We have a different way of studying it, which is where you take a small pellet of basically tritium and you hit it by very powerful lasers from all directions, all at once. That will vaporize the outside of the shell and literally implode the shell. And when it does, you might get very hot and in confined space and cause some fusion to happen. That's something which is known as inertial confinement fusion. And up until about 2 years ago, the cutting-edge facility in the world for that research is the Laboratory for Laser Energetics, about a mile and a half from here, right on East River Road. And if you've ever been there, if you have a chance, take a tour and look at the facility, because basically they have a huge facility where they have huge lasers that are designed to send beams and implode small pellets. About 2 years ago, a new laboratory came online called the National Ignition Facility, which is bigger than the LLE, at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. And you know, so they're still trying to figure out how to create sustained nuclear reactions in a laboratory on Earth. Whenever you ask them, they will always tell you we're 50 years away from having fusion power on Earth in a controlled fashion. So, unfortunately, that was also true when I was in graduate school. I think it's a sliding target. It's technically a very hard problem, but you do have a lot of very good people working on it. And I sort of wanted to bring it up in part because even though there's now a bigger facility in California working on the research problem, it's an engineering problem, and the LLE is still playing a really important role in the development of that kind of physics and technology. So a little bit of local lore of relevance. So, any thoughts, questions? All right, so I'm almost out of time today, but let me spend a moment and let me get started at least on the life cycle of stars. Back in the day, I would say 1910s, 20s, 1800s, it was a tremendous puzzle as to what was the power source of the sun. if you imagine the sun was a huge ball of coal, and then we know the mass of the sun, we know its energy output. These are things that we knew in the 1800s, the problem. So if you take its energy output and you calculate how much energy could come out of coal per kilogram, and you look at the mass of the sun, you can calculate that the sun would last, and I forget the number now, 4,000 years, 10,000 years or so. So we, of course, have lots of geological evidence that the sun is much older than that. So there's this tremendous puzzle as to what is the energy source of stars. And it turns out that the energy source in stars comes from thermonuclear fusion in the center of the sun, the center of the star. Where does that come from? We're going to talk about cosmology, and we're going to talk about the initial elemental distribution in our universe, and how we sort of know what it is. So we'll talk about a lot of that. It turns out that you can calculate interstellar space. You think of as a vacuum. It really isn't the perfect vacuum. It turns out that it has one atom per 20 cubic centimeters, and that's interstellar. That's not near where you have a star, which of course is much greater, thank goodness. But it turns out that after the early stages of our universe happened, Big Bang started, the universe is about 89% hydrogen, 9% helium, and 2% light elements. So first of all of the elements that were created in the Big Bang were very light. So just small elements. Almost all of it is hydrogen. And we will talk about what happens with stars at their later stages, but it turns out that it's in the when stars enter their final stages of what their life cycle, they can undergo tremendous explosions where they can create the heavy elements. But that didn't come from the Big Bang.
So where does all this start? I have all this hydrogen out in space, and if I have some sort of fluctuation in the gas, and I get slightly higher density over here, say instead of 20 atoms, one atom per 20 cubic centimeters is one atom per 19, then I have a little bit more mass in this region than I do over here. And even though the numbers may seem very small, you do have gravitational effects. So ever so slowly, you'll have asymmetries in this gas, and you'll begin to condense the gas. As it condenses, slowly you'll actually form what you can observe as a gas cloud of hydrogen. And in time, that starts to even get what we would consider to be fairly dense. And as you take the gas and you compress it, it will get hot, which you probably know if you pump up your own bicycle tires. If you take a gas and compress it, you feel the nozzle, and it'll actually pop. Or the other way around, if you've ever taken a fire extinguisher that's under pressure, and or a spray paint can, and you've taken a gas that's under pressure and let it out, it gets very cold, because as it expands, it absorbs it. So as this gas condenses due to gravity, it will get hot, and that heat will slowly bleed off into space. And it even can do it in a visible way, but most of it will happen in infrared, so frequencies we're not so used to. So I'm out of time, I'll come back, but that's sort of the start of the star. So we're going to talk about the life cycle of stars, start of class on Monday. locked out. So
it's okay. It worked well.
Yeah. Oh, it's Steve.
Yeah, that's very good.
This works fine.
Yeah.
I don't believe that. And this works fine. You can see it.
You
can see
it quite well. So thank you.
Next week.
Yeah, so next week, let's see, I'm going to talk about stars and particle physics. So this was a good demo for...
I can't fit it to the
GP. Well, we just saw it, so
okay.
We'll meet it again. Probably nothing.
I'll
have to contact you if something, yes. If I think of something. This class starts to be increasingly hard for demos because I start talking about particle physics and cosmology and astronomy and so.
Okay, we'll see you then.